Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, in acknowledgement of Women's History Month, I am going to read an article I wrote for my Once Upon a Time newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, which I published for nearly 30 years, a truly homespun endeavor. Ms. Smith Goes to Washington. I am dividing it into two parts, as it is too long for this half-hour program. Next week is intended to be part two, if, of course, I am still my corporeal self, which, at my decrepit age, is chancy. This is obviously in honor of National Women's Month, although, of course, every day is Ladies' Day, as the old song attests. And in particular, I dedicate this program to Suri Mirzapossi, whom I have loved for nearly all of our lives and who remains my closest friend. Yesterday, March 19th, was her birthday. Ms. Smith Goes to Washington. And a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt. Women must get into the political game and stay in it. Despite the fact that the binary political party system seems determined to stick with two white males for the nation's highest office, a woman elected president of the United States in 2024 could definitely alter this course of empire and radically avert the bullying schoolyard machismo that has characterized American politics since the beginning of this new century millennium, which Richard Goldstein depicts as terror of a world without male white power. It is shameful that women are summarily cut out of any viable prospect for attaining the presidency. Prominent and well-qualified women of the two major political parties are seldom given a decent opportunity at the White House, except as First Lady, which was certainly demonstrated in last year's presidential election. Quite the contrary, the nation has been saddled with the swagger of blustering maleness, despite a popular majority of women voters whose choice was denied by fraud and corruption at the very top of male-dominated power. American women have had the vote for a century, an almost equal amount of time women spent fighting to attain it. For most of those years, women rather passively voted the way their husbands or boyfriends voted. Women voted for the first time in equal numbers as men in 1980, and in 1982, more women voted than men, although women voted differently than men that year and succeeding years, they did not necessarily vote for women. A significant change was made in 1992 when women campaigned in unprecedented numbers for every conceivable office in the country, local, state, and federal, including at least one woman for president. Women entered politics backed by other women, finally using their majority power to elect women to public office. It is not impossible to imagine a woman as president. It is a much better idea than the knee-jerk assumption that only white males are the only reasonable choices for the presidency, a form of gender apartheid by a status quo unwilling to see beyond its own shriveled genitals. There is certainly precedence. Liberals and leftists have periodically fronted women for president, more often than as VP in third parties, such as the American Green Party in 2000, with Winona LaDuke sidekicking Ralph Nader, and once in the Democratic Party with Geraldine Ferraro in 1980. Women have contributed hugely to American history, But as it is with blacks and others who have helped build this nation, their contributions have been ignored and undervalued. Even before Europeans settled the Americas, American women were powerful forces in their separate communities and tribal councils. Iroquois women owned the land and controlled the economy by supervising the distribution of food. The Cherokee Women's Council helped select male leaders, declared war, and determined the fate of captives. In 1540, Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto was welcomed in present-day Georgia by a woman chieftain who gave him a string of pearls. Perhaps the beginning of the present-day women's movement was in 1640, when Anne Hibbins of Boston insisted she had the right to complain about male carpenters she had hired. Church elders attacked her for thinking she could handle such affairs better than her husband, quote, which is a plain breach of the rule of Christ, unquote. She was excommunicated and was hanged for witchcraft 16 years later. During the Revolution, women served on battle lines, manned cannon, such as the famous Molly Pitcher, who took over a cannon when her husband was shot, nursed, wounded, and cooked for the militias and regular troops. City women raised money for food and clothes for Washington's ragtag army. In the meantime, frontier women fought Indians unleashed on western settlements by the British. In 1777, several Daughters of Liberty stripped a man who criticized the Revolution, covered him with molasses, and stuck on dozens of flower petals. Philadelphia women in 1780 called for action in a broadside titled The Sentiments of American Women. They described themselves as born for liberty, disdaining to bear the irons of a tyrannic government, quote, unquote. In 1787, the new United States Constitution left the determination of who was eligible to vote to the states, but did not specifically bar women from holding federal office. States' rights meant then, as now, limited participation, or none, by those outside the white male status quo. New Jersey's state constitution gave the vote to all property owners worth a certain amount, which left wives as well as unmarried women ineligible. However, the state's election law was briefly revised in 1790 and referred to voters as, quote, he or she. New York specifically denied voting rights to women in its constitution in 1777, and other states quickly followed suit. Thomas Jefferson, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, which the month of July is annually obliged to celebrate, said as president in response to a suggestion in 1807 by Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin, quote, the appointment of a woman to office is an innovation for which the public is not prepared, nor am I, unquote. Is the needle sufficient? Judith Sargent Murray wrote in her essay on the equality of the sexes, which appeared in Massachusetts Magazine in 1790. Writing under the name Constantia, she argued that women's and men's mental abilities were equal and proposed full education for women. Will it be said that the judgment of a male of 2 years is more sage than that of a female's of the same age? She asked. I believe the reverse is generally observed to be true. But from that period, what partiality? How is one exalted and the other depressed by the contrary modes of education which are adopted? Grant that their minds are by nature equal, yet who shall wonder at the apparent superiority? And That was by Judith Sargent Mary. The 19th century began with women voting in substantial numbers in the 1800 presidential election. But in 1807, New Jersey changed its election law once more by inserting the words white and male into its voting requirements, and women were not permitted to hold office in any of the states. In a manner similar to the civil rights movement of the 1960s, spawning white anti-Vietnam War activists, the women's rights movement of the 19th century converged from the pre-Civil War abolitionist movement. Men initially controlled abolitionist groups, but frustrated women broke off and formed their own abolitionist societies, which generally included black as well as white women. Women agitated for equality long before the American Revolution. A group of women complained in a letter to the New York Journal in 1733, "We are housekeepers, pay our taxes, carry on trade, and most of us are she merchants, and as we in some measure contribute to the support of government, we ought to be entitled to some of the sweets of it." As the result of a successful case by a Virginia slave in 1655, that she was a free woman because her father was white, southern colonies, including Virginia, declared that all newborn African Americans were slaves, regardless of the parents' status. A century later, a woman won her freedom in Massachusetts after arguing that she was illegally enslaved because her mother was white, which meant she was born free. In 1701, six men and six women were selected for an Albany, New York jury, which was an exception. During much of American history, women were kept off juries. Not until 1975 did the U.S. Supreme Court rule that women's automatic exemption from jury duty is unconstitutional. Many other instances of women defying religious and royalist male authority occurred before the Revolution. Hopes were high among many women that the Revolution would be truly revolutionary and allow them equal status. But liberty for all, and that's a quote, was selective and left out women and slaves of both sexes, and, as it turned out, working class people as well. In the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors, Abigail Adams wrote in a 1776 letter to her husband John, a delegate to the Rebel Congress in Philadelphia. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands, Abigail Adams wrote. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. She scolded her husband for not taking her advice in a letter 2 months later. I cannot say that I think you very generous to the ladies. For whilst you are proclaiming peace and goodwill to men, you insist upon retaining an absolute power over wives. But you must remember that arbitrary power is like most other things, which are very hard, very liable to be broken. And that was a quote from Abigail Adams. In regard to state suffrage, by 1910, Oregon had failed to pass five such referendums, but that same year, Washington became the first state since 1896 to grant women the vote, approving the measure by almost 2-1. In 1911, suffragists mounted an intense campaign in California, and by 3,857 votes, the state's women won the right to cast their own ballots. In 1914, suffrage was on the ballot in 7 states. Defeated in Missouri, Nebraska, Ohio, North and South Dakota, it won in Montana and Nevada. 4 East Coast states voted down suffrage in 1915. They were Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. 2 years later, New York overturned the earlier vote and became the first East Coast state to grant women suffrage. Also that year, 1917, women gained the right to vote after legislative action in 6 states: Indiana, Michigan, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, and Rhode Island. They also won the right to vote in primaries in Arkansas, Michigan, Oklahoma, and South Dakota gained full suffrage the following year. And in Texas, women were allowed to vote in primaries through legislative action, though literacy tests prevented many Black and Mexican-American women from voting. The House of Representatives approved the 19th Amendment in May 1919, 304-89, after a lame duck Senate defeated it in February that year. The Senate finally reversed its long rejection to women's suffrage in June with a vote of 66-30. Within 1 week, 3 states, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan, ratified the amendment, and by the end of the year, more than 20 states had passed the measure. By the end of March 1920, 35 of the required 36 states had ratified the amendment. A single vote in the Tennessee House of Representatives in August, Harry Byrne, whose mother was a suffragist and told him to be a good boy and vote for ratification, gave the U.S. Constitution its 19th Amendment, which was declared official on August 26th. 2 other states, Vermont and Connecticut, ratified it later. 10 states did not ratify the 19th Amendment. They were Alabama, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, Virginia, North and South Carolina. The 38 states that approved the amendment were more than the 3/4 of states needed to pass it. Throughout the suffrage struggle, America's history, her principles, her traditions, stood forth to indicate the inevitability of women's suffrage. Yet the years went by, decade followed decade, and 26 other countries gave the vote to their women while America delayed. Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers Schuler wrote in their 1923 book, Women's Suffrage and Politics, The Inner Story of the Suffrage Movement. Why the delay? We think we have the answer. It was not an antagonistic public sentiment, nor yet an uneducated or indifferent public sentiment. It was the control of public sentiment, the deflecting and the thwarting of public sentiment, through the trading and trickery, the buying and selling of American politics. We think that we can prove it. At a National Women's Party convention in 1921, Alice Paul introduced what she said was the next women's rights issue, passage of an Equal Rights Amendment. In 1923, the NWP started a new journal, Equal Rights, edited by Edith Houghton Hooker, and introduced its Equal Rights Amendment, nicknamed the Lucretia Mott Amendment, into Congress. This bill stated, quote, "Men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction," unquote. Many women's groups and labor activists opposed the bill because it eliminated hard-won protective legislation for women workers. Indeed, the Supreme Court invalidated a minimum wage essentially because it did not give men and women equal rights. Reintroduced into the House by Congresswoman Hattie Caraway in 1943, the ERA was changed to read, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex, quote, unquote. Failing to pass, women in several states set up ERA committees that lobbied state legislatures to pressure Congress. The Senate voted on the ERA for the first time in more than 20 years in 1947. The count of 38 for and 35 against was far short of the two-thirds majority needed. In 1967, the National Organization for Women, NOW, made as one of eight demands included in its Bill of Rights, immediate passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. Finally, in 1970, the House approved the ERA, 350-15, after only an hour debate following Representative Martha Griffiths' successful effort to get it out of the Judiciary Committee. But the Senate refused to vote on the ERA until 1972, following intense lobbying by women's groups, especially NOW. The measure was approved 84-8. By the end of the year, 22 states, led by Hawaii, ratified the amendment. In addition, six states, Colorado, Hawaii, Maryland, New Mexico, Texas, and Washington, added equal rights amendments to their state constitutions, preceded by Pennsylvania the year before. However, by 1978, Congress was urged to extend the ratification deadline beyond March 1979 because a shortfall of 35 out of a required 38 states had ratified the ERA. 7 years were requested, but Congress extended the deadline only 4 years to June 30, 1982. ERA supporters not only fought campaigns to pass ERA in the states, but also ones to rescind it. In 1979, NOW and other groups managed to head off attempts to revoke ERA ratification in 13 states, but were unable to gain any new states. The necessary three states never ratified the ERA, although polls showed that 63% of the public supported it, with only 32% opposed. 15 states rejected the ERA, and four others attempted to rescind their support, but the move was thought to be unconstitutional. Among the main arguments used to defeat the ERA were the specter of women being drafted and forced to serve in combat, the potential loss of alimony and child custody preference in divorce cases, and the possibility that tax money would have to be used for abortions. Anti-feminists also put forth absurd but highly symbolic scenarios, such as unisex toilets. Right-wing women such as Phyllis Schlafly and her Eagle Forum, dedicated to family values and law and order, considerably upset the ERA campaign. The present-day feminist movement incubated between the suffrage and ERA movements and emerged in the late 1960s as vigorously renewed successor to women's rights movements that had languished in the post-World War II years. In November 1968, about 200 women from 30 cities attended the first National Women's Liberation Conference, which commemorated the 120th anniversary of the first women's rights meeting at Seneca Falls. Radical women of color were not invited, which created problems later. The situation between the sexes now and throughout history is a relationship of dominance and subordinates. Kate Millett wrote in her 1970 book, Sexual Politics. However muted its present appearance may be, sexual dominion obtains as perhaps the most pervasive ideology of our culture and provides its most fundamental concept of power. This is so because our society is a patriarchy. The fact is evidence at once if one recalls that the military, industrial, technology, universities, science, political office, and finance, in short, every avenue of power is entirely in male hands. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. In 1971, Bella Abzug, Shirley Chisholm, Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem, and others helped found the National Women's Political Caucus, which was devoted to increase women's political strength by organizing local caucuses, backing women candidates, and assuring fair representation of women and their issues within the leading political parties. 40% of the delegates to the 1972 Democratic National Convention were women, compared to 13% 4 years earlier. GOP women delegates to the Republican Convention in 1972 made up 35%. Also in 1972, Shirley Chisholm became the first black woman candidate for the presidency. I have met far more discrimination as a woman than being black in politics, she said. But in spite of it all, I went to the Democratic Convention and began to open the way for women to think they can run, quote, unquote. That year, NWPC set up two associations to train women for political participation and to help finance women candidates, the National Women's Education Fund and the Women's Campaign Fund. In 1974, Ella Tambusi Grasso became the first woman governor elected entirely on her own without succeeding a husband. Connecticut elected her by a significant majority, but only 11 states have ever had women governors, and only Texas has had a second woman governor. The other states that have elected women governors are Alabama, Connecticut, Kansas, Nebraska, New Jersey, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and Wyoming. The best way to assure recognition of women's political concerns is to elect office holders who not only are pro-women's issues, but are women themselves, Eleanor Schmiel wrote in Women on the Ballot and in Office in 1984. Women should think seriously about running for office and encourage other women to do so. The quickest way for us to elect more women to public office is for more women to run as candidates.